Thank you for joining us. My name is Katie Heinle, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can be like Brian, Jody, Jerry, Garrett, Ben, Janet, and John, and support the podcast on Patreon with either a recurring or one-time donation. This helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Peyton Thomas. Peyton is a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Colorado Boulder in the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research. Here she works with Drs. Cassandra Brooks and Keith Musselman on the Arctic Rivers Project, where she studies growth projections of Arctic fishes under mid-century climate change across the Alaskan and Canadian Yukon subarctic and Arctic watersheds. She received her PhD in biology and marine biology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington in 2022, where she studied fish muscle physiology and potential adaptive responses under projected end-of-century temperature scenarios and extreme hypoxia. Throughout her academic career, she has sought to understand both anthropogenic and natural influences on organisms. Peyton is also a member of the Patagonia Trail Running Team in Protect Our Winters, where she bridges her love of running with environmental advocacy. All right, welcome to the podcast, Peyton.
Thanks, Katie. Nice to be here.
Good. All right. Well, I always like to start with people's background. So where did your interest in fisheries first begin?
Yeah, I would say that my interest really began when I got to college. I was always interested in aquatic systems generally growing up, but I had never really had exposure to fish or fisheries growing up. It was more just like I'm playing around in streams and creeks around me and like seeing all these random animals, like mostly turtles and frogs and stuff like that. But yeah, my interest in fish really started with the research that I was exposed to when I first got into undergrad at Baylor University. And yeah, just blossomed from there. And really, I kind of got thrown in directly to marine systems and coastal systems. Even though my university wasn't on the coast, it was just like smack dab in the middle of Texas, which is like also interesting, but definitely gave me an appreciation for fish really in most ecosystems, like not just marine, because even living in the middle of Texas, you're exposed to like all these crazy fish like gar and sturgeon, all these things. And I loved it. So I was like, I gotta learn more. And yeah, so it was pretty cool.
That's awesome. Could you talk a bit about what you were originally going to study for your master's and what caused you to switch to a PhD program?
Yeah, the story is kind of wild. It also kind of follows up with, like, basically this is kind of my narrative that I use a lot when I talk about like climate change advocacy too, and some of the work that I've done with Protect Our Winters. But I originally went into grad school for a master's in marine science, and my project was originally going to be focused on invasive species impacts on shellfish hatcheries across North Carolina. So I was looking specifically at invasive tunicates, or people call them ascidians, but they're like these solitary filter feeding animals, and one of the top 10 invasive ascidian species in the world is present across North Carolina, and it outcompetes a lot of oysters specifically in shellfish hatcheries, and shellfish are a major commercial resource for North Carolina. So I was just getting into this, especially coming out of undergrad and doing fish specific work. I was like, are fish really what I want to study, or do I want to look more at invertebrates? I don't know. So kind of just being really open to that. But even in doing that, I learned a lot from doing that work, but I kind of realized that I do love studying fish and like love studying animals that move also. It's really, really fun and useful. But with that, like I was in my master's program for a little over a year and was like doing this whole field component that was just about to end. It was about 6 months into the field component of this research. And this major hurricane hit Wilmington, where I did grad school, and it completely wiped out my research project. And it also caused a lot of damage to the science building where my lab was housed. So like we lost a lot of equipment. I lost all of my samples that I had been working on throughout that entire summer, and like all of our reagents, because I was in a biochemistry lab. So yeah, I basically lost everything. I was like one of a few graduate students that like had to kind of grapple with what do we do after this major natural disaster. And in that time, I was like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what my life is. But it was also like this moment of sort of reconciling with my own, like this really big impact of a climate change fueled disaster on my own life, and like reflecting on how that impacts me versus other people that also live in the same area, and like how are their experiences different from what I'm experiencing, being someone who's privileged, and like the only thing that I really got destroyed was my research, which is still a really big deal, but like not at the same scale of like losing your home or losing your family or like, yeah, lots of other issues that can come with that. So yeah, that moment both made me realize like, okay, I should maybe figure out what I really want to prioritize in my research. And then also like, maybe I should, like, I really wanted to feel more deeply connected with the community that I was living in and make a difference, because I didn't really know like, if my research was going to be useful or impactful for anyone or anything. And so from there was when I like really started wanting to gear my research and just like my general interests, hobbies, whatever, into more climate change advocacy. So luckily, following up from the hurricane, I got the opportunity to switch my project to focus on sharks, because one of my friends was already doing research on a couple of species that are based in Australia, and she was looking at thermal stress and impact on shark brain development. And the lab that I was doing my graduate degree in is very much a like biochemistry lab, like very molecular heavy on stuff. And I was interested in like more climate change related questions. It's not typical for my lab to do. So I thought that would be kind of cool to like use these techniques that we have in like a more traditional biochemistry sense for questions that are applied towards answering like what are actual impacts that could happen to different species when we talk about climate change. So I switched my research to start working on just one project originally, looking at high temperature impacts on epaulette shark muscle development when they're reared under these higher temperatures, and what does muscle development look like at this early life stage, and what does that mean for how they grow into adulthood, and does that impact their growth trajectory, this impact like accumulated stress markers, and ultimately result in higher mortalities, because that's been shown with some other species and no one's ever done it in a shark species. So I wanted to pursue that. And then what came out of that was like, wow, yeah, I actually really want to continue to study fish. And I also really want to continue to pursue work that is directly focused on climate change impacts. And then it was like that next spring, I got the opportunity to transition into a PhD. And I chose that one because I was like, well, I don't know what, like, I was trying to grapple with what I would get out of a master's versus what I would get out of a PhD. And I was also brought a couple of other projects to my attention that really interested me. And I was like, well, if I get a master's, then I can't work on these projects. So I might as well just stick with a PhD and do the stuff that I want to do. So yeah, I transitioned like the next year after the whole hurricane disaster happened. And yeah, I don't want to say I didn't look back, but I was like, there were definitely moments where I was like, I don't know if this was the right decision.
Right.
But I feel like everyone has that.
Yeah.
So I don't feel alone in that.
Yeah.
But so then the rest of my dissertation followed similarly with the epaulette project, where I was working on a couple of other species of elasmobranchs, so Port Jackson sharks and then little skates, looking at thermal stress, temperature impacts on early life history, musculoskeletal development, and are there implications for these possible changing growth patterns into adulthood or later juvenile life stages. And then I did another random project. I say random because it wasn't related to to any other project that I was working on, but I was just like, well, I want to gain skills in respirometry and look at hypoxia. There's a lot of issues with coastal hypoxia, especially in North Carolina, especially in Wilmington, because of all of the agricultural runoff and the increasing prevalence of storms. And so being surrounded by a lot of talk about that just had me thinking about different strategies for hypoxia tolerance in different species and what would it mean to look at hypoxia tolerance, not just from this like behavioral lens or lens of looking at respiration rate, but how do you actually see that show up in body tissues? And can we learn something from species that are really hypoxia tolerant in terms of their strategies that are happening at different biological scales? Yeah. So kind of all over the place and just reaffirmed my that I should probably continue to work with fish.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I can relate on a couple levels because I started as a master's student and switched to a PhD, and mostly I'm like, yes, this is a good decision. And sometimes I'm like, I don't know why I didn't just stop with the master's.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's also cool. Can you talk about, I was going to say briefly, but maybe talk as long as you want about it, some of the key findings from your dissertation work?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my work was kind of just like, well, we found this and who knows what it means right now. Yeah. especially because for the first few chapters that were really focused on early juvenile musculoskeletal growth, it's hard to say, well, I guess first that the three species that I studied, they're all from different parts of the world. So like the epaulet shark and the Port Jackson shark are from Australia, but from opposite sides. So like the epaulet shark's from the Great Barrier Reef. Port Jackson shark is more temperate, subtropical, its distribution, and it's more southern Australia. And then the little skate is in the North Atlantic. So from that perspective, just considering where they are latitudinally, also just their different life history patterns and behaviors as species, it was interesting to see differences in the way that they handled pretty similar levels of thermal stress. And I say this because with the epaulet sharks, the study that I was doing was coming off of a couple of other studies that were more behavioral in the species. So looking at like a 3 degrees Celsius increase in temperature for juveniles that are growing under these higher temperatures, they showed pretty significant differences in their metabolic rate. So they had higher oxygen consumption rates and they were slightly smaller at elevated temperatures. And then what I found in my muscle development paper was that even though I did a bunch of measurements of muscle morphology, which is all kind of boring, but the pictures are really pretty. Basically, what we found was like, okay, the muscle didn't actually grow differently, but we are seeing signs of possible oxidative damage stress. And that is really interesting in a species that is considered to be tolerant of really high temperatures, hypoxic conditions, and leads to a lot of questions of like, this species is considered one that's of least concern in terms of being endangered, being threatened by possible climate change impacts. But if you're already seeing signs of stress at this juvenile life stage, that means that there are probably some other scaling effects of that once you get to later life stages. And we don't actually, I don't think everyone is kind of on the consensus with the epaulet sharks that we shouldn't be so sure, basically, that they're going to be okay. And like, maybe we should rethink management of this species or rethink how they're actually going to behave under climate change and kind of think how species will behave just generally, because I feel like in a lot of cases, also when people think about sharks, I don't know, most people are only thinking about like the big pelagic shark species and not necessarily these smaller ones that are also really important to these ecosystems that we love. But yeah, like getting other considerations for how species will respond is super important. And then with the Port Jackson shark, I wasn't able to get measures of oxidative damage, but I did similar measurements of muscle morphology changes. And what was cool with that was like with the Port Jackson sharks, I was looking at individuals from two different populations. So one is from more of the southeastern coast of Australia, and then the other is like directly south. So it's like around Adelaide, and they have pretty different thermal regimes. And so it was like this cross reciprocal experiment where you're exposing the populations to similar thermal regimes and then to their normal ambient thermal regime and seeing how they respond. But it was cool because you could see like population level differences in how they were responding to a temperature change. So like one population actually showed increasing blood capillary densities than the other, and also more than the ambient temperature ones, which is showing that they might be responding to this increase in temperature by trying to increase oxygen consumption, because there's an increasing oxygen demand in that system, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So it's showing that like this species is showing an ability to adapt, but really only in this particular population, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been done in a shark before. And also just shows like differences even in shark species that are around the same region, kind of. So I thought that was cool. And then with the little skates, it's just like, they are fine. like their muscle development didn't change at all. And I did this, like, I don't know if we want to go into it. It was kind of a lot. I did a lot of like investigative molecular work.
Yeah.
That was like, as you do when you're just like a scientist that's like alone in a lab and you're like, right. Hey, I can do this. And
yeah.
It would be cool. But yeah, basically no changes in skate skeletal muscle, okay. Which is kind of cool, because also in previous studies that I've looked at temperature stress in this species for juveniles, it's showing that they are pretty tolerant of a wider temperature increase than a lot of other species. And it might be due to the nature of their environment that they are a more temperate species. So they're already exposed to all of these like wider temperature variations, but other variables like acidification or like changing salinity might be more stressful for them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's even been, I think it's like the North Atlantic Fish Commission has also been finding that little skate populations have been actually migrating further south to a little bit warmer waters, which is interesting. So all really different. And I thought it was cool to just like have similar methodology in the way that we're looking at thermal stress in a few Lasperbank species. Yeah. And then the hypoxia tolerance study was just like, I looked at these two cows. Sorry, you can tell the exasperation in my in my face and my voice. It's a lot to talk about, but the hypoxia tolerance was in two killifish species, and they're like both coastal sawmar species in North Carolina, and they're both pretty common, but one species is like way more well studied than the other for hypoxia tolerance. So it was more investigative in terms of like, well, does this other species respond similarly in terms of metabolic depression, possibly with decreasing oxygen concentrations. So it's like, is that its way of coping with low oxygen? Does it lower its metabolic rate or its energetic demand? And we found that yes, that does happen. And then I was looking at also molecular markers of oxidative stress and like strategies for combating that. So looking at particularly protein degradation pathways, because that's how the body will help get rid of oxidative stress, is by recycling a lot of damaged molecules. And so basically what we found with that is that depending on the level of hypoxia, certain types of protein degradation strategies are going to be used. But really, like oxidative stress, there wasn't that much oxidative stress in either species. So it was kind of just like this investigative study. And I think the biggest finding out of that was just like, yeah, they employ a very similar mechanism for dealing with low oxygen, but that this other species that was way more well studied would still probably be considered more hypoxia tolerant, just because the level of hypoxia that it could experience without keeling over, which was like loss of equilibrium, if you've mm-hmm. ever heard of that.
Yeah.
Just like when the fish just like teeters over and doesn't yeah. respond to anything anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like that level of hypoxia was lower for the species that was more well studied than for this other one. But I think still super important to understand, especially in systems that are becoming even more hypoxic due to climate change impacts and other mm-hmm. human development impacts. So yeah, sorry, that was not brief.
No, that was great. Well, I was just like, all the projects are like different enough that I was like, there's not a brief way to summarize, but it's all super interesting. So that was great.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So your postdoc is part of the Arctic Rivers Project, and I was wondering if you could first explain what the Arctic Rivers Project is.
Yeah, so the Arctic Rivers Project is this NSF-funded project that was under the Navigating the New Arctic grant cycle. And so the whole purpose of the project is to bring together both Indigenous knowledge, primarily from Alaska and Canada, and different types of science. So we have this group of scientists that range from climate scientists to hydrologists to fish biologists, ecologists like me, and then social scientists. And so all of these people are working together to try to understand what climate change impacts will look like for people across this region in Alaska and Canada. And the way that the project was developed was really because of like deep collaborations that were already ongoing with the social scientist that we have on our team is from the United States Geological Survey. So she already had really deep connections with people in Alaska and Canada within Alaska Native and First Nations communities, and then interest from these communities in terms of like having science that will be helpful and actionable for them to develop some adaptive planning within each community, because everyone knows, and I think we hear it enough, honestly, that like the Arctic is warming extremely fast and like the fastest out of the entire world. And like the fact that these communities are feeling this on a daily basis is pretty real. And there's also this feeling that like there's so much science going on in this region, but not necessarily all of it is actually going back to the communities and not reaching people in ways that is necessarily helpful. And also a lot of these communities don't really have an ability to like change policy on like a state level or a federal level. Like there is becoming increasing ways for representatives from communities to be present on panels and commissions that will hopefully lead to policy change, but that's really slow going. And the mechanisms for people to actually do something are pretty limited within the scope of like being involved in larger government systems. So being able to provide science to them that could be helpful for them, like within their own communities, is really useful, I think. And also as a team, we're like still trying to figure out how to actually like it's a constant conversation, like, okay, we have these models, but like, how do we make this useful for communities?
Yeah.
And I think where we really get to that is like with the river modeling and the fish modeling, because the climate model, we have really amazing climate modelers on our team that have developed like several different scenarios that were chosen based off of input and feedback from people in communities. So like people didn't want to have scenarios that were based on like end of century projections, for example. They wanted stuff that is very soon to come, so then they know what they can plan for like in the immediate future, which I think is really cool and helpful. And I don't necessarily think that a lot of people are doing that. Most climate projections that we have are for the end of the century.
Yeah.
We're like, okay, but like what about now? Yeah. What are we doing now? Yeah, because people have already been seeing impacts that were projected to happen like 20, 30 years from now. So it's a very real issue that's happening. Yeah, that's pretty much what we're doing.
And then I was wondering if you could talk about how your research specifically like fits in, or like what aspect you're tackling for this project.
Yeah, so my side is the fish side. I am currently working on different bioenergetics scenarios for different fish species. So my part of the project is the last end of this larger Arctic Rivers project. So the way our modeling chain works is it really started with the climate modelers and like creating these decisions around what models to use and what timing we're going to use and what scenarios are people most interested in. So all of these climate models were developed, and then all of that climate information was input into hydrological models that were developed primarily from the PhD student on our team, Dylan Blasky. So he's generated both hydrological models of stream temperature and discharge across all of Alaska and the Canadian Yukon for the historical period and mid-century period. So our historical period is from 1990 to 2021. So obviously pretty contemporary. But that's because people have like the most recent observations from then. And also in terms of water quality data, we like don't have anything earlier than like the 1980s. And the same goes with fish. So yeah, a lot of that river information was fed into my fish bioenergetics models. And I am developing models primarily for four species right now. to be determined if I will work on more, but these four species that we chose were chosen because of input from communities. So we held a summit in December of 2022, which was like a series of workshops. We called them like participatory workshops, and we had one big one that was like participatory mapping, where you bring people from similar regions across Alaska and Canada, set them in front of these different maps, and they describe places like where they go fishing, where their village is, where they've seen things in the past, where they see certain environmental things happening or disturbances happening in those locations, and then have another session where people are describing like fish that they harvest, observe regularly, or that they have like stories or traditions around. And so a lot of that information was used to decide for me specifically what locations I'm going to be using for the fish bioenergetics models, because I can't model all of Alaska right. since it's really big, and I don't think we would get very much out of that. and then also the species that are of interest. So I was trying to pick species that were mentioned the most by these different communities, but also species that are kind of on this like line of being understudied, but mm-hmm. we have enough data to like right. at least get something from it to try to formulate some possible scenario for like what growth could look like for the species into the mid-century. So like that part was really difficult to get to. It was just like really figuring out what data is available and what species are for sure a no-go for trying to do this kind of modeling, since bioenergetics modeling requires a lot of data. So we came up with four species right now. So Chinook salmon and Dolly Varden, as well as burbot and broad whitefish, are just some of many other species that a lot of these communities will harvest. But it's kind of cool, at least with those four, is that like, communities will harvest them at different times of year. So it's good to kind of get a holistic view of what the possible changes to each of the species is. So then, yeah, you can kind of get an idea of how does this impact harvest in the future for certain people. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. And then I think another goal I have, I don't know if I'll end up getting to this by the end of my postdoc, but is to be able to use some of that bioenergetics information to inform some species distribution models. So then it's like more tailored to the species physiology rather than just mm-hmm. presence,
right?
Or like these weird relationships. But yeah, that's what I'm doing.
That's awesome. It's also really cool to actually have an example of a project that's like built based on the community needs. You didn't just decide what fish you're going to do and be like, hey, what do you think about this? It's like actually coming from the community first, which is awesome. And I feel like this is not as common as it maybe should be.
I think we're getting there, but yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. So I want to shift gears a bit, since you are a professional trail runner and have weaved in some environmental advocacy with that work with Protect Our Winners and your Equitable Action Run Towards Health race that you led in Mississippi. So I was curious what inspired you to weave these passions together, which I guess maybe you touched on a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think partially because at least when I still feel pretty new to trail running, but I'm not new to running. And I've always been really interested in environmental justice issues and equity issues, as well as being interested in like science mm-hmm. in different ways that I've often gotten asked the question of like, well, how do these relate to each other? And I'm like, you can be a multifaceted person, right. like different things. But also it really made me think about like, okay, are there ways that I could actually combine these things with each other that like really aligns with my values? Because also I'm not really seeing a lot of people doing that necessarily. Like, and I got inspired with running in particular and environmental advocacy through some fellow trail runners, actually, that had like sort of started this conversation in the running space about like, well, what are we doing actually to protect these places that we are recreating in, and like, and not just recreating in, but like that people are living in, that they're having these daily lived experiences with natural disasters or pollution. Like, how do we as a running community contribute to the problem, but also how do we contribute to the solution? And so I was really inspired by a lot of people in that way. And yeah, I think, yeah, just like constantly asking myself that question of like, what am I going to do to help bring this together? And so I feel really lucky in that I got connected with Protect Our Winners in particular, because they've gotten a lot better at really introducing athletes in particular to ways to develop our own narrative and also pursue projects that we're interested in and like pursue weird ideas that we have. And the Earth Run was one of my weird ideas that came about partially because of my experience in North Carolina, both as a graduate student, a scientist, and a newly budding trail runner.
Mm-hmm.
And like just a person like living in the Southeast, because I've grown up in the Southeast my entire life, but had never really understood or like never really knew about the wood pellet biomass industry, which is what the Earth Run was about, was like, how does the wood pellet biomass industry impact both people living in the communities surrounding these plants and surrounding places where trees are being extracted from, but also how is this intersection, what is this intersection with race and identity, and how can running influence this? How can running be a part of the conversation? And for me, it was definitely a part of the conversation, because like one of the ways that I even got exposed to knowing about this industry was actually through trail running, because North Carolina has like tons of rural pockets. Actually, I shouldn't even say pockets. It's like mostly rural, but there are like pockets of big cities. But with that is like you're driving through all of these really beautiful places and like very diverse ecosystems. But also what that means is like there are a lot of small towns and places that you don't really get to know necessarily unless you're intentionally going to a place to go to some random trail that you found out about on like on a trail app, like All Trails. And so yeah, like a lot of my early experiences through trail running were driving through these small towns that were actually big extraction points for trees for the wood pellet biomass industry, and also towns where plants were actively being operated. And in this experience of like having running be my way of discovering that particular problem, it was also just this question to myself of like, okay, well, I know this is happening and people are actively trying to get rid of the presence of these plants, or they're trying to regulate these things a little bit more, trying to protect the people living in these towns. But like, how can I, with my running platform or my experience, use it to also help with this problem? And it was kind of like a kismet situation where I had like just really been researching this issue more. One summer, it was like my last summer of grad school, and it was also my first real summer of pursuing trail running like in a more competitive level, and I was really excited. And so I was going up to Virginia for a trail race to meet one of my friends who lives in Asheville, North Carolina. And she was like, oh, one of my friends is also going to be running this 50K. And so I met her, and she was actually the director of this nonprofit, the Dogwood Alliance. And Dogwood is one of the main nonprofits that is focusing on the wood pellet biomass issue. And I was like, okay, weird. Like, I've been reading a lot more about this, and now I get to meet this person, and she's really cool, and she trail runs too. And she like obviously is very intimately connected with this problem. And so after the race, I was like, you know, I've been thinking a lot about how you can combine trail running with like talking about this issue. And she was like, yeah, we should work on a project about this. And then fast forward to a year later, because I needed time to like write the dissertation and like be done with all of that, and was like getting more connected with people in Dogwood. They had me go to some events that were happening in South Carolina that Dogwood was supporting for different indigenous communities in the area. So I was getting more intimately connected with the organization. And fast forward to like summer 2022, I'm like, okay, Rita, that's the campaign director, or she used to be the campaign director of Dogwood that I met. I was like, okay, we're going to apply for this grant, and we're going to put on a like running race in Mississippi, because it was like one of the towns that she had given me contacts for in Gloucester. It's like, we're going to do this. Like, I think it's a really good idea. And at the very least, it's going to be helpful for raising awareness about this problem and putting more visibility on this town so they can actually get some more resources sent to them. And so we did, and we got the grant. And then I was like, cool, I guess now I have to put on this race. And I have no idea how to do that. So that all happened. And then fast forward to basically a year later, putting it together and getting more connected with people. And it was actually really cool because it was interesting to see the way that running and is really superficial and frivolous compared to people's lived experiences dealing with pollution on a daily basis and talking about that at a policy level. But at the same time, the whole way that I was framing the race, or I was framing it as a run really, was it's a place for community building, a place for joy, a place for people to specifically experience joy outside in this place where really the environment is kind of used against them, used against these people, because it's causing a lot of health impacts, the air pollution from the plants and the fragmentation of these forests. And so in that way, I feel like the run is kind of this space for a bit of levity when you're talking about an issue that's really hard to talk about. But it's also when you have something like running as a space to talk about these issues, there's just more opportunity to bring more people into the conversation, because it's not so hard to really engage when you're in a space that's not intensely serious and based on people's hardships necessarily. Yeah. And so I think it was cool to put on an event that could provide that sort of space. And I'm hoping to continue putting on events like this. I just need to get more funding. But it was really cool to really put that together and engage with people in the community and hear their needs, and also connect it with health equity issues that are happening at this larger state level. It just opens up a lot of avenues for ways that running and environmental advocacy intersect with real issues that are happening to people on a daily basis that I think we need more of, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a question that we can skip if you want. I'm just kind of curious. I know there can be this school of thought in academia that advocacy and science need to be completely separate. Have you dealt with any people who have really strong feelings in that way, or any pushback for this environmental advocacy work that you've done?
I really haven't at all. Yeah.
Right.
But fingers crossed that never happens. But also I feel like I'm coming to a point, especially in my postdoc, trying to figure out where I'm going next in my career, but realizing that I do really love advocacy and I love science and I love outdoor interests and things like that, but also just engaging with communities that are underfunded in so many ways and need a lot of resources, also want they want to have data as leverage for accessing grants and things like that to actually adapt to these climate change impacts, different environmental issues. And it's just really had me thinking more that science is a form of advocacy for different problems. Wherever funding is directed towards in science, you're advocating for that particular research interest. And to say that advocacy work is not allowed in science doesn't make any sense to me, because science literally is advocacy for whatever ideas and thoughts you have. And communities want and need that. They need science to be able to even have a platform anywhere, or tell agencies, oh no, we need this, we don't need you to come in here and conserve this area, we need you to conserve this area, and we have the data to show you this. So yeah. But no, I haven't experienced any pushback yet.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. That's what I was hoping I would hear, but I was curious about it. So.
Yeah.
Cool. My next question is just, I was wondering what your favorite parts about your running career and or environmental advocacy are. You can have one for either or both or neither.
Well, I definitely feel like I'm still in my environmental advocacy journey. I really feel like, to be honest, the exciting experiences are more so to come, because there's a project that I'm hoping will get funded in the next year. We're basically trying to combine trail running to conduct this field expedition to go do EDA and otolith collections on this island and involve the trail running community and communities in the whole project. So I really think that is a bud of it'll combine all the things. But I guess to talk about one experience that was both running and environmental advocacy, it was within my first year being a Patagonia athlete. They asked me to be a part of this trail running route through the Boundary Waters that this guy, Alex Falconer, who's actually now, he's going to be running for office pretty soon, which is kind of crazy because he's like worked in DC a lot as like a policy manager for this nonprofit called Save the Boundary Waters. But he had this idea of running 100-mile route through the Boundary Waters because there are a couple of trails that go through and they connect with each other, but like the Boundary Waters trails are very bushwhacky and like just don't get a lot of trail maintenance very often and like just very unpredictable. But he had this pitch to Patagonia that like he wanted to do this as a way to really raise awareness about the threat that the Boundary Waters is under for this proposed copper mine that was there. It's still under investigation with the Biden administration, thank goodness. But this was in 2021, so it was right at the point where the Biden administration had to decide whether that was going to be under investigation or not. It was called the Twin Metals Copper Mine. But I loved that because, one, it was my first big Patagonia project. Two, because, again, he was running 100 miles, so I ran like 30 miles with him on the trail, and I never met him before going out to Minnesota to run this with him. And it was just so fun to like get to know him more in this way and experience this place because I'd never been in the Boundary Waters before and like just really experience the beauty that was there and hear all of his reasons, his own personal reasons for wanting to protect this place, and then see how the culmination of this running event reached a bunch of different people because it resulted in a small film. And he talks about this run in so many interviews, articles, and now on its campaign trail. And it's just like so cool to see these things come together. And just like, all I did was run with this guy in the Boundary Waters. But it was cool because it was like me and a couple of other professional trail runners coming to support him and the protection of this place, which is cool. And to just like experience the Boundary Waters in that way. Because we also did canoe through there afterwards, but it was not nearly as long as the running. And I don't think, and I'm not very good at portaging a canoe. But apparently, I'm blanking on the town. I think it may be Ely, but they do like a marathon where people portage a canoe for the whole marathon. So they kept joking with us, like this one guy who also works for the Save the Boundary Waters nonprofit. He was like, "Are y'all gonna come back and do this marathon?" I'm like, no. None of us have the upper body strength. But I loved that experience. It was so fun.
That was so cool. Okay, I am also curious, just being a PhD student myself and trying to imagine balancing all of the things that you did, how do you balance running at such a high level as you're getting your PhD and as you're like currently working as postdoc?
Yeah, I do think, I mean, being a postdoc, at least in the postdoc that I'm in right now, is a little more lax than other situations. And also because right now, like, I'm strictly doing research, so I have a lot more flexibility around my schedule, but it's still a lot of work. But in my PhD, I was really just getting into trail running and was more doing like a mix of road and trail running, which is a little bit easier. And also, I mean, it was still hard because I lived on the coast and I had to take a lot of trips back and forth to the mountains to go train on any sort of hilly terrain. But it was really just like prioritizing my time. And I will say I wasn't the best at like hanging out with people in my PhD. But I feel like that happens anyway because you're like busy in your own work. But yeah, I don't know. I had to like justify times where I just wanted to go spend the weekend like hanging out in the mountains with no one else but myself and running as just like, oh, this is me time. Like I feel like that's so hard to do, especially in grad school and even in a postdoc, is like you're allowed to have time for yourself. And I kind of had to force myself to do that. And it was kind of easy to justify because I'm like, well, I am doing a lot of lab-based work, some field-based work, and this is my way to like connect with the environment in this way. And that will ultimately always help me in my research because any way that you can feel connected in some way to your surroundings is useful and grounding. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and like I didn't pursue racing a ton. Like some people in the trail running space will be racing primarily during the spring and summer, will race a ton every other week or something like that. But I just don't do that. I pick a few races that I'm really interested in and then I go for them. And I think that also just puts the pressure off a little bit. And also because travel can still be expensive when you're trying to race that much. And yeah, it's just like, I think always just trying to find a balance in what you can handle.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe sacrificing some pupil time.
Yeah.
But pupil time is a lot easier in a postdoc, I will say.
Yeah, so, good.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So I usually try to ask people what their hobbies and interests are out of science. But I'm going to adjust since we just talked about your running work. So do you have any hobbies and interests outside of science and running that you spend your fun time with?
Yeah, it has been nice post-PhD to really pursue other things of interest, I will say. Yeah, so like I have been really interested in pursuing more music. I used to play piano when I was a kid and like got really sick of it because I like competed in recitals and stuff and didn't want to touch a piano for several years after I finished high school, but I finally got back into playing piano, which has been really wonderful to just like feel some sense of creativity, because I think especially being a scientist, I don't necessarily feel like I know how to be creative. Some people do it so well and I'm like really impressed. But yeah, I need to figure out what my creative outlets are. So really exploring that through piano again has been pretty cool. And then I had this idea last year to get a bunch of small portable instruments, just like start collecting some so then I could bring them to random places and then ask people to play with me. So I've been on a musical instrument collecting journey and I have acquired like, I think maybe like 5 different instruments since then and have been dabbling in them myself. And then yeah, if random friends want to play, then it's all fair game. So that's been pretty fun. And then I've also been really interested in exploring a lot more dance lately. Like I'm not a dancer by any means, but I think it's like really fun to find more ways to like explore movement in your body. And since running is so like straightforward and linear, I'm like, it's good to have some other types of movement that I'm doing.
Right.
So yeah, just mostly stuff like that. And then yeah, it's just been nice to actually feel like I have a good community of friends that I can hang out with a lot. So yeah, definitely feeling more balanced and like I do have other hobbies.
That's awesome. That was very good to hear.
Yeah, it does get better.
Yeah, all right. Well, this brings us to the end of what we call the tough part of the interview and are down to our final 5 questions, which is a group of questions we ask each of the guests that come on the show. The first one is, what is your favorite fish?
Yeah, I saw that question. I was like, this is hard.
Yeah.
And I will say, okay, yeah, so I thought about it and it's not any of the fish that I've studied because I feel like some people are like that where they're like, yeah, my favorite fish is this one that I studied for like 10 years. But I actually really am in love with any sort of lump sucker species, but mostly because I just love the name and I love how ridiculous they are. And I have a tattoo of a Pacific spiny lump sucker on my shoulder. Her name is Gloria and she's really cute. Yeah, but I just like, I don't know, I think they're adorable little balls of just like tubercles. And yeah, they don't really do anything crazy, so yeah.
That's awesome. I feel like I've had at least, you're at least the third person to say Pacific spiny lump sucker, and I feel like the more people say that's their favorite fish, the more it becomes my favorite fish, because I like, it's like, oh, I need to look this up again, and they're so cute and so hilarious.
They are so cute. Yeah, and there's like this, like I'll look up random papers too of them, just like, because there's a lot of morphological papers on them, because they, my partner studies, he's like doing marine-inspired robotics stuff. And he's looking into drag reduction stuff right now. And we both like geeked out about this drag reduction paper on Pacific Spiny Lumpsucker for like completely different reasons. But it was really exciting. But yeah, they're like, what, like 30 something species. And I don't know, they're all really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. All right, what is, I'm so happy you answered like that.
Yeah. No real reason. You're just cute. Yeah.
What's your favorite memory from your career so far?
Yeah, that one's also really hard. I don't even know, because I feel like most of my best memories were like any time I was out in the field, just like playing around in the water. So when I was doing my hypoxia tolerance study, we were out catching fish in this salt marsh, and we were seining in the marsh because it's like one of the easiest ways to catch fish when you're out there, because the tide fluctuates so much, so you can't really use a lot of other methods. But yeah, so like there was this one part of the marsh that we were trying to walk through, and I was with a couple of my other lab mates. I'm the only person in my lab that's like wearing waders, because I just can't, I don't know. I don't like being in the marsh without waders, because I'm just like, I can step on anything. There are oysters out here. There are stingrays out here. There's like so many things, and I'm just I can't be bothered with that. But so we didn't know how deep this water crossing was, and my lab mates were like, you got it. Like, you're the only one wearing waders. You should be the one to go out. So I was like, okay. So we go out, and immediately the sediment drops off so much, and it's just like this really steep slope, and I'm carrying this net, and the current is going through really fast. And so I'm like stumbling through the water in my boots, and like, if they're so close to getting filled, my waders, and I'm like freaking out and thrashing, somehow making it through this current, and like the net feels so strong, and so I'm like, did we catch something? Is it just the current? I don't know. And I'm just like struggling to get across the water, and then my other lab mates are just like unbothered, like going in the shallower section of the marsh, and we finally both end up on the other side of the bank and like end up pulling this net in, and we get this massive stingray. And I was like, I was elated but also so tired and also so terrified, because the stingray was like 2 feet wide and so big, and I was like, oh my gosh. And I'm just thrashing around like an idiot in this marsh, and we have this thing here, but it all ended up fine, but it was like both funny and a little bit scary. Yeah, about that a lot.
That's awesome.
Note to self, maybe don't go in wader boots in the marsh that you don't know how deep it is. Sorry, hard to tell.
Yeah, good life lessons.
Yeah.
All right, what is your dream job and or location?
It's also hard. I don't necessarily know if I have a dream job, or like, I don't have a dream position, but I think my dream job would be to be the lead of a long-term ecological monitoring program, because I really love the idea of being so deeply connected with one place and like studying one system, really knowing the community around there, and really being able to develop long-term projects that have a benefit for both the ecosystem and the community. And yeah, I don't know where that would happen, but I'm still trying to figure that out. But I think that's like generally my dream job. And then dream location, I mean, right now I've really been enjoying living in the mountains in Colorado, but I do really miss being by big open water, so I'm trying to figure out what my next move is, if I'm gonna like stay in the mountains or be somewhere that's got mountains and coastline, or what do I want? I don't know. But I've had this idea in my head of like maybe just moving to Barcelona. But I think I need to like get a job there first. Right. But it seems like fun, because it's got a good mix of like, it's a big city. It's got a lot of things to do. It's very multicultural, and you have the coastline, and you have the mountains right there, and it's all pretty accessible. Yeah, and seems like fun, and it's not too cold. So it's outlined in my brain, but whether I can make that happen and this monitoring program, I don't know. We'll see. But I can also compromise.
Yeah. It's good to have goals.
Yeah. Yes.
Awesome. All right. This might lead into your last answer, but if money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
Yeah, it would definitely be. I mean, I think right now, I'm even in conversations with people from the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council about basically trying to develop this fish monitoring program in communities. And I think that would be so amazing to do, to set up a large scale program like that where communities can basically develop their own set of research questions that we can tangibly answer through this big network. Because I think what's so beautiful about the Intertribal Watershed Council and Alaska Native and First Nations communities is they have this long-standing relationship with each other and this deep connection with each other, like all across the river, even though there are intertribal differences and differences depending on what region you're in. But ultimately, everyone just wants the best for the rivers and the fish. And I love that. And like having that base for any sort of long-term program seems so cool to me. And I'm like, we just need money to make this all happen and like streamline everything. And so I think that would be probably an immediate project. I don't know if I'm necessarily gonna stay working with Arctic fish or not, but it would be amazing if I could. And to have the opportunity to set something up like that would be really wonderful.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. All right, our last question is, if there's one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
That, I don't know, I feel like I've had to tell myself this a lot, is like, especially being in academia for a lot longer than I expected I would be, it's just like reminding myself that I have good ideas and I'm valid. I think I have a hard time just generally feeling that, but, and I know a lot of people have that feeling, but I tell myself that in a lot of different realms of life. And like, the more often I tell myself that, the more often I believe it. And especially when it comes to like ideas of trying to blend these different things that I want all together, I always have to sort of reaffirm myself that like, you're okay, you're doing great, and you're valid in your feelings, and you can pursue what you want. And yeah, just keep going. You're fine. Yeah. I don't know if that's a great like succinct message, but that's what I would tell myself.
No, that's perfect. Yeah. I think everyone needs a little more. Well, I at least need a little more self-confidence. I don't know if everyone does, but I think a lot of people do. So.
Yeah. Most people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Peyton, thank you for coming on the podcast today. This was so much fun, and it was so fun to hear about all of your work. If people want to find out more information about you or get in hold of you, either for running, environmental advocacy, or science-related questions, what's the best way for them to do that?
They could email me. Do you want me to get my email?
You can. I can also just copy it in the show notes. So either works.
That might be easier. Yeah, they can email me. I have a website. There's a contact page there. If people want to contact me there, it immediately just shoots to my email. Or I'm also on Instagram. I can give you my Instagram. Yeah. But yeah, all the things.
Awesome. Very cool.
I hope that you all enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to get a hold of me or the podcast, you can find us on social media at Fisheries Pod, or send us an email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Katie Heinle. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, you have great ideas and you are valid.